Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Here we're going to be in Job chapter 12 through 14. It's real important that we see the flow of the book of Job. One of the best little commentaries out is a commentary on Job by Francis Anderson, put out by InterVarsity Press. It's the Tyndale Old Testament commentary. In this book, there is an outline of the dialogue that's found. There are three different cycles of Job's dialogue. Chapters 12 through 14 forms the conclusion to the first cycle. Now, the reason that's so important is this. In chapter 12, Job is going to answer not only the biting accusations of Zophar in chapter 11, but he's really going to use the plural you in verse 3, which means he's talking to all three of the friends collectively. I'm sure Job thought that his argument was over, and yet it's just round 1. There's going to be round 2 and 3. This is the largest, as far as size, answer that Job gives to the three friends. Now, later on in the book, there's going to be a longer response of Job later on when the whole argument's through, but this is the longest one of any of these three cyclic responses. Okay? Let me kind of outline chapters 12 through 14 for you. Number one, chapter 12:2 through 13:12 is Job speaking to his three friends, sometimes Zophar individually, most of the time the three collectively. Then in 13 through 19 is a brief transition where Job is trying to get up his courage to move from talking to the three friends to talking to God. And then in chapter 13:20 through 14:22, Job addresses God directly. Some of the most famous quotes from all the Old Testament are found in this section of Job. I think we're going to enjoy looking at it together. Let's begin then at chapter 12, verse 2. Boy, Job, you've got some biting sarcasm right here. Then, truly then, you are the people, and with you, wisdom will die. What he's saying is, you're the know-it-all. You know everything under heaven. You're the ones who think you're so knowledgeable of theology. Boy, it's a biting sarcasm. Now, in verse 3, you see the two yous, they're both plural. He's speaking to the three friends. Then in the latter part of verse 3 it says, and who does not know such things as these? Well, what Job is saying is, yes, you've passed theology 121, but you've never gone beyond that. Everybody knows what you're saying. It may be a reaction to the simplistic answer to life's deep moral mysteries that has been expressed by Zophar in chapter 12, verses 7. Chapter 11, verses 7 through 12. And that may be what's happening here. Okay? Now, look at verse 4. I am a joke to my friends. The one who called God and he answered him, the just and blameless man, is a joke. Well, what are you saying is you guys are making me out to be a fool. You think that I don't understand anything about God. You're giving me traditional, simplistic answers. I've tried to tell you I've tried to tell you my situation. I've tried to explain my heart to you, but you won't have it. You just have it all in a box, and you won't listen to anybody. Friends, I know some folks like that today. And Job's saying, you've made me a laughingstock. And I'm a blameless and righteous man. That's been Job's position. Job has asserted that he is suffering innocently. And the three friends have said, oh, come on now. You know all men are sinful. You know you're paying a price for some hidden sin. Just confess, and God will restore you. Now, that's been their position. Chapter 5, 17, chapter 8, 20, chapter 11, 14. And Job says, no. Really, I don't know why I'm suffering. Now, this is the theological, philosophical problem of Job. Why do the righteous suffer and the wicked prosper? That's what Psalm 73 is all about. That's what Jeremiah 12, 1 through 4 is reacting against. And so he says, y'all have made me to be a theological nunu and y'all to be the theological professors, but I want you to know it's just reverse of that. Woo, Job, don't get up. Don't get too mad now. Look at verse 5. He who is at ease holds calamity in contempt as prepared for those whose feet slip. He says, yeah, it takes one to know one. It's real easy to talk about the theology of suffering when you're not suffering. It's real easy to talk about, oh, well, those people must deserve what they're happening to them when your life is fine and everything's going well. Boy, it's real easy to talk about problems. You don't have any, isn't it? Now, this deal about your feet will slip, This is kind of a play on the Hebrew word for faith, which is the Hebrew word amen, which means to be firm or to be sure. It's used of God picking one out of miry clay and setting his feet on a solid rock. It's used in the sense of not letting my foot slip. For you see, biblical faith is pictured as a pathway or a well-worn wagon track. And God's given us guidelines. And if we trust him, our feet will be sure in that path. But we begin to sin, our feet get slippery. And that's the background, this metaphor here. Now, verse 6. The tents of the destroyers prosper. Now, many translations have robbers, but this is the age-old question. Why do the tents of the robbers prosper, and a righteous man like me who offers sacrifice for his kids, who prays, who loves God, what am I doing on an ash heap filled with sores? And that's the question here. Now, this last little phrase, 6b, by the way, I want to say, I think this again may be a reaction to the simplistic answer that's been given in chapter 11, verses 11 through 19. Now, the last part of 6c, is very difficult in the Hebrew text. And I hope you'll get all the English translations in your home and look up how they translate it different. And you'll see what a problem it is to know what this means. It seems to mean maybe the robbers feel like their own hand is their God, or that they manipulate their own destiny. That seems to be the best that I can do with that. Now, in verse 7, down through 12, Job says, "Let the animals teach you." He's really using the concept of natural revelation, that God has spoken through nature, that God has spoken the order of creation, and that man can know something about God from nature, from the animal kingdom, from creation. Now, this is the focus of Psalms 19, where the first part is natural revelation, and the second part of the psalm is special revelation. This is also true of the book of Romans, chapter 1, 19 and 20, about that all men are guilty because all men know something of God from creation. And that seems to be the basis here. Now, verse 12, if you have the King James or the Revised Standard Version, you might notice that verse 12 is an affirmation, as is my New American Standard. But there's a real possibility that it's a question, and that changes the whole meaning. You might want to see chapter 32, verse 9. Okay? Now, in 13 through 25 of this of chapter 12, this seems to be emphasizing the sovereignty of God over the conditions of powerful, influential men and nations, which simply means, Job is saying, even the powerful men are at God's beck and call. Now, maybe he's reacting again to the simplistic answers of Job's friends. We're just not sure. But this seems to be that all things are in God's hand, and then 13 through 25 are pretty negative. The king gets in trouble, the counselor gets in trouble, the judge gets in trouble, the powerful one gets in trouble, the influential ones gets in trouble. God's in control, the destinies of men is the basic affirmation of these chapters. Now, going on to 13. 13 begins much like 12 begins. So it's obvious we're going into a second kind of dialogue of Job's answers to his friends. In verse 3 he says, "But I would speak to the Almighty." Now the Almighty is the Hebrew word El Shaddai. It is basically the patriarchal name for God. It was not until Moses at the burning bush that God revealed his unique covenant name, YHWH, that in your Old Testament is the word Lord with all caps. You can see it in Psalms 110. It says, "The Lord," all caps, "said to my Lord," little O-R-D. That's the word Adonai. And so, basically, it's the patriarchal. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob call God El Shaddai. Okay? Now, notice where it says in verse 4, "You smear with lies, and you are worthless physicians." Now, the word smear means to paint or plaster. And so what Job is saying is you're just trying to cover over the problem with a Band-Aid. You're just trying to paint over the rust, but the corruption of your understanding will show through. And then he says, "You're like doctors who have diagnosed and prescribed my condition totally in error." Wow, boy. Now, in verse 7 and 8, this is something that I really want to pick up on. It says, "Will you speak of what is unjust for God and speak what is deceitful for him? Will you show partiality for him? Will you contend for God?" Now, what they're saying is, and I've already felt this sometimes when I have listened to preachers who really twist the Bible around, that whatever the Bible says, they can explain it. There's no moral problems. There's no dialectical tensions. There's no problem in the Greek manuscripts. There's no problem with quoting the wrong prophet. There's no problem with numbers. Every time there seems to be a problem in the Bible, well, they can explain it away. You know, I think to myself, what could God do if he wanted to shake us and say something that wasn't accurate? We would make excuses, and you know what? You know what? We do not have to defend God. There are a lot of people running around worried about God's reputation. My brother, you let God deal with his own reputation, and you don't have to explain in simplistic ways the mystery of the ages concerning the human condition and the nature of God. There's some mystery here. And these folks were saying false things in God's name for the best of reasons. But they were conservative. They were traditionalists. They were orthodox. And I want you to know in chapter 42, verse 7 to 9, God calls them to give an answer for their false theology they were so committed to. We need to realize that we are sinful men. And that when we have done our best at understanding God, we are still sinful. We need to hear that. Well, I tell you what, verse 9 says, what will you do when God puts you on trial for what you've said that's false? And God does, chapter 42, verses 7 through 9. Now, in verse 12, he says, your rememberable sayings are proverbs of ashes, and your defenses are defenses of clay. What he's saying is, everything you've said to me are useless, just useless. You haven't comforted me, and your theology stinks too. Now, in verses 13 through 19, this is the transition where one of the famous quotes come from, where Job is trying to say, let me kind of paraphrase it first, then come back. Job believes in the justice of God and in his innocence. Now, he won't let go of either one of those. Now, there are times when he has great doubt, and there's time when he has great faith. And boy, it's all mixed together. And doesn't that just sound like us? Great doubt and great faith wrestling sometime with how and when and why. But still, he believes in the justice of God and in his own personal innocence. So what he's going to say is this. He's saying, whatever it takes, whatever are the consequences, I want to talk to God. Now, this is not a legal case. He's not saying, I want to bring God to court. Who's going to be the arbitrator with God? But he's saying, God, I want to lay my case before you. I want you to tell me why I'm suffering when I've tried so hard to be right and honest and true. Now, that's what we have here. Listen to this. He says, be silent before me so that I may speak, and then let what come. Then I should take my flesh in my teeth and put my life in my hands. And what he means there is, if I approach God, I'll probably die. You know, who can approach God? Then in verse 16 he says, that may be a real point on my behalf that I'm willing to approach God, because no sinner would certainly want to approach God, but I want to approach God, he's saying. I want to talk to the judge and the justice of the universe. Now, here's this famous saying. Though he slay me, I will hope in him. Nevertheless, I will argue my ways before him. Now, this has been, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. You've got to see the context here. He's not saying, oh, if God just kills me, I'm still going to trust him. He felt like he was saying, I want to see you, God, face to face. Even though if you kill me, I still want my day in court. Now, that's really what he's saying. This is not gray faith without mixture of doubt. He's saying, I want my day in court. Whatever the consequences, I want to see you, and I'm going to hope that you'll let me do it. Now, that seems to be the background of this, and you can look at modern translations. The last part of verse 15 says that our traditional ways of interpreting this don't really fit the context. And then in verse 16, this also will be my salvation. Now, remember, salvation is used in the biblical, Old Testament biblical sense of physical deliverance. Man, he wants to get out of this disease. He wants to get off this ash heap. And I think there's something of the spiritual relationship, but mostly it's physical deliverance here. And then he says, for a godless man may not come before his presence. He said, this isn't a half bad deal. The fact that I want to come before God and willing to put my life on the line ought to tell you men, you three friends, that I'm serious about my innocence and about my belief in the justice and trustworthiness of God. Now, he moves from that, continuing this same idea down to verse 19, all right? Who will contend with me? For then I would be silent and die. It's the same, I want to see God, okay? Now look at verse 20. Only two things do not do to me. He has two prayer requests. Number one, remove thy hand from me. Take this sickness off me, God. And number two, let not the dread of thee terrify me. Friends, you know, I watch TV sometimes, especially the Dodgers. where God's referred to as the big dodger in the sky. And I feel like I need to move out away from the TV set because lightning's going to come. There is an awesomeness about God. He is the creator and everything is created. And Job has caught a sense of this awesomeness. Now, by the way, Job wants to speak to him. Job wants to talk to him. But Job still has there's a tremor in the force when he wants to talk with God. And I think we need to catch that balance of, yes, I want to speak to him, but I'm a little afraid of God. We need to keep that healthy fear, I think. Now, notice in verse 23. How many are my iniquities and sins? Make known to me my rebellion and my sin. Now, this is not saying Job is admitting he's a sinner. He's going to say down in verse, let's see, where is it? He's going to mention that he's had sins in his youth. I've lost that place right now. Yeah, verse 26. He's not saying he's sinless. He's saying, but surely God wouldn't go way back in my past and dig up something back there and say, now I've killed all your kids and I've taken all your possessions and I've struck your body because of that sin way back then. Job never claims to be sinless. He just claims to be open-hearted before God. He's not claiming he doesn't have any problems in his life. He admits that in verse 26 he does. But what he's saying is, God, I don't really know where I failed you. I don't know where I've sinned in such a way as to deserve this, or this is the norm of your way of dealing with men. And so he's not admitting great sin, or his three friends would have won the argument. He's saying, God, if I am guilty, if they are right, God, show me, and I'll give it to you. That's what it seems to be saying. Now, look at verse 24. He says, you've hidden your face from me. You're treating me as an enemy. Then in verse 25, will thou cause a driven leaf to tremble, or will thou pursue a dry shaft? What he's saying is, I'm like a little ant. You don't have time to mess with me. I don't amount to nothing. Why are you spending all this energy on getting on my case? That's what he's saying. Look at verse 26. For thou dost write bitter things against me. Thou dost make me inherit the iniquities of my youth. Well, all of us have sins. It's kind of like saying, did you write all those down, the book of remembrances? Okay. Did you write them down and now I'm getting this judgment for those things way in the past? Put stocks on his feet, does watch all his paths. Here's the idea of God who's bound his life and yet watches him even bound. There. Now, in chapter 14, we're moving to a little different level now. We're still in his response, but a little different level. It's not as intense. Now, it's going to have a very famous passage in it. It's not as intense as 12 and 13. Listen to what he says. Verses 1 through 6 is going to deal with the finitude and insignificance and frailty of human life. Man who is born of woman is short-lived and full of trouble, full of turmoil. I remember I was doing a revival in Louisiana one time, and I asked this little church, I said, someone tell me your favorite verse. Well, I was expecting John 3:16 or Ephesians 2:8 and 9 or something, you know. And some guy got up and quoted this and looked at his wife, and I thought, boy, he must have a miserable life for this to be his favorite verse. Well, this is really an expansion of chapter 13, verse 25. Man is born, and he's got problems, and he's got all the things that just seem to inflict him. Some die young. Like a flower, he comes forth and withers. And that metaphor is used throughout the Bible. Psalms 90, verse 6, Psalms 103:15, Isaiah 40, verse 6, James 1, 10 and 11, 1 Peter 1, 24. Man's a flower, a little wildflower that comes up and just a few days is gone. Frailty of human life. He's a shadow, a veil, a vapor. That's the same idea picked up in Ecclesiastes and picked up in James. What is your life but a vapor, a mist? It's gone, here and gone. Now in verse 3, what we have here is, thou dost open thine eyes on him and bring him into judgment with thyself. Now, Job wanted to talk to God, right? He's saying, now, God, I want to talk to you. And look in verse 3, he's saying, but who can stand before God? So, you know, he's caught between wanting to see God because he feels innocent and the awesomeness of the Creator God. And boy, I feel that fluctuation. Sometimes I want to be with God and sometimes I want to be as far away as I can get. You ever have that? Now, this deal about verse 4, clean and unclean. Some have said, well, this is referring to the uncleanliness of birth. Now, you've got to remember Jewish psychology. Any kind of bodily omissions, any kind, made someone unclean. So the birth process in and of itself made someone unclean. So do we have here in verse 4 the concept that birth itself, man is born of woman, that he comes in the world unclean? Or do we have an incipient form of the doctrine of original sin? The same question comes in Psalms 51, where in sin did my mother conceive me. The bodily emissions there, the sexual act, because the Jewish view of these excretions, they consider to be somewhat unclean. That's why you couldn't have sex before these feast days and stuff like that. The New Testament does not hold to that. And so I think it's a more of a cultural thing than a universal truth. Now, it has always been surprising me that the rabbis do not have a doctrine of original sin. Now, they believe in the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer HaTov, the evil impulse and the bad impulse are in all men. But Christianity, especially Paul, the classical passage would be Romans 5:12 and following, developed the concept of a fallenness, going back to Genesis 3, that all men are born in a condition of a propensity toward rebellion. Okay? I'm not sure which one it is here. By the way, the latter, in 4b, my New American Standard has no one. But there's a real possibility that the little Hebrew phrase El could mean God. And so some interpret no one except God can make the unclean clean. That's a better theology. But whether it fits in the context or not, I'm really not sure. Verse 5, all my days are numbered, my months are numbered, the limits has been set, and no, he cannot pass. That reminds me a lot of God's sovereignty. And not only God's sovereignty, but God's providence in individual lives. Another good place to look would be Psalms 139. Or if you want a negative way of the same truth, Romans chapter 9. Now, verse 7 through 12 talks about a tree dies, it might live again, but when men die, it's all over. Now, this famous quote is down in verse 14. If a man die, will he live again? Now, I want to say to you, and listen to me now, because I am a contextual exegete. The famous saying in verse 14 must be related to 7 through 12. The traditional theology was when a man dies, he goes to Sheol. He's conscious, but it's a miserable existence, no fellowship, no friendship, nothing. Okay? Now, based on 7 through 12, Job is either reacting to traditional theology, or he is going beyond traditional theology, or he is making an astonishing affirmation of faith far beyond his days. Now, you must decide. I think probably all three are involved in that. Thou will hide me in Sheol, will conceal me until thy wrath turns to thee. What he's saying is, God, I'd just soon die and get your anger over and then let you deal with me some other way. Well, have you ever been so sick you've been ready to die? Boy, Job is sitting on this ash heap with sores all over him. His three friends come to console him, and all they do is blast him. Job is very close to doing what his wife said right here. Okay? Now, if a man die, now you can try that, will he continue to live or whatever? All the days of my struggle, I will wait. Now, the Hebrew word wait is exactly the word hope that's used in that famous, famous statement over here in chapter 13:15 about, though he slay me, yet will I hope in him, yet will I wait patiently for him, yet will I trust in him. That's that same Hebrew word. So these are connected. It's the ideal of faith and patience mixed with doubt and impatience. It's love and trust in God mixed with fear and anger over what's happened to him. Man, I feel that sometimes, don't you? Until my change comes. What change is that? Well, from life to death, resurrection, from healing out of disease? I'm not sure. Now, verse 15. That will call and I will answer thee. That will long for the work of thy hands. Now, here he's saying that there's going to be fellowship beyond the grave. And that's what Job, I think, finally comes to. He's saying, look, life's unfair. If this is all there is, God's unfair. But God made me, and God loves his creation, and God somehow, in his own mystery, in his own time, in his own way, God is going to work it out because he loves his creation. You'll see chapter 10, verses 8 through 13. Fellowship and justice beyond the grave seems to be what 15's talking about, and if that's true, then 14 may very well involve an incipient form of a belief in resurrection. Now, in Job 18 through 22, Job fumbles the ball of faith again. Friends, he didn't fumble it. He fumbled it clear down the field. He's moved from the highest point of hope in an afterlife God's going to do something beyond the grave. God's going to bring justice. God's going to renew His creation. Somehow God's going to do it, even if life is unjust. And then immediately He comes into 18 through 22, which is so negative. Kind of reminds you of Elijah up there on Mount Carmel. What a great high thing. And then next minute he's running out of fear from Jezebel. Aren't we that kind of people with those highs and lows? Oh, we are. So was Job. It's so good to look in a man's heart that's struggling with the justice of God and circumstances and yet comes out in faith. Boy, what a chapter. Well, I hope you'll read this and outline this in your own words. I've enjoyed being with you. Let God be God. Don't try to solve all the mysteries. Just hang in there and trust in faith. Even if it's mixed with doubt, it'll be worth it all. I'll see you next time.